BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is Hella Pick. As a journalist, she covered the stories that shaped the 20th century. She was there for Martin Luther King's March from Selma, the Paris protests of 1968, the Watergate scandal in America, and the Gdansk shipyard strikes in Poland. One of the very first female foreign correspondents, she spent 35 years at The Guardian, and says it's no accident that foreign policy was her specialism. She arrived in the UK alone on a Kinder transport train as a 10-year-old refugee from Nazi-occupied Austria. Celebrating her 90th birthday next year, she's far from retiring. She's published a biography of Simon Wiesenthal and is currently working with the think tank, the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, and with Sussex University to establish the Weidenfeld Institute of Jewish Studies. "I have a deep sense of belonging to Britain," she writes, "but I still wonder whether anyone not born in this country is ever wholly accepted or integrated. This Kinder transport person needs to know that there are also wider horizons that remain to embrace her and to embrace." Hella Pick, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
And Hella, you were one of the first women to occupy the role of foreign correspondent. How conscious were you that you didn't fit the mould at the time?
Well, very conscious, because my very first job was mostly in West Africa. We're going back now to 1958-59. And I was virtually the only European woman journalist covering that whole field. So obviously I was young, I was quite good looking, everybody was running after me, but in the nicest possible way. I got to know all the leaders of West Africa, and I had a very good time. And the handful of European male journalists took me in and treated me as a comrade.
Now, I've yet to mention your formidable reputation that you earned for yourself. There is, I think, a possibly apocryphal story about a cluster of dignitaries hiding from you in the gents. What really happened, Hella?
Well, this was when I was the Guardian's United Nations correspondent. And in those days, around lunchtime, the diplomats would gather in the delegates' lounge for drinks, and the journalists had access to that. And, you know, we would all go and try and talk to them. And I was trying to write some story, and I was desperately looking for one of the members of the British UN delegation. Couldn't see any of them. Finally, I asked a French diplomat, "Have you seen any of the British? What's happened to them?" And they said, "Well, they're all in the men's cloakroom hiding from you."
I hope you got them in the end.
I did. They had to come out. They wanted their lunch.
Now, what about the music that you've chosen for us today? What place does music have in your life?
Music has a great place. I couldn't live without music. I spend a lot of time going to concerts, and opera is really one of my very favourite occupations. And, you know, I find increasingly when I'm working now, I like to have some background music. And that's bad, because it's just sort of somewhere in the background and you're not really listening. But it's a good companion nevertheless.
Well, let's hear the first track that you're going to take with you to the island. What's it going to be, Hella Pick?
Well, it's going to be Schubert's Trout Quintet. This has a sort of special meaning for me, because as a school child, I went to school in the Lake District. There was a small group of adult refugees who were musicians, and my mother used to take me to these concerts. And one of the things that I remember they played there was the Schubert Quintet. Thank you.
That was the fifth movement of Schubert's Trout Quintet, performed by Jacqueline Dupré, Daniel Barenboim, Itzhak Perlman, Pinkas Zikman, and Zubin Mehta. So your work, Hella Pick, covering many of the major events of the 20th century, also, of course, led you to interview the major players from every part of the political spectrum. When you look back at those encounters, which have stayed with you most vividly?
I would actually say two completely contrasting ones, both relating to Poland. I was due to interview General Jaruzelski, who was then the ruler of Poland. And it had obviously been difficult to get that interview. And then on the day that I was supposed to interview him, Brezhnev died. So I thought, well, that's the end of my interview because Jaruzelski will be rushing off to Moscow to the funeral. Instead, I was told he would see me that evening, and I was taken through dark corridors to his room, and he presented me with a large bunch of roses and then gave me written answers to the questions I had written for him and then allowed me to interview him properly for about half an hour. Next morning, I opened the party newspaper, and there is my interview on the front page of the paper, over and above the story about Brezhnev's death. And I thought that was really a significant moment in terms of Poland's relations with the then Soviet Union. Then the other Polish interview was really not quite an interview. I was in the church in Gdansk with Walesa on the day that he received his Nobel Prize. He was not allowed to leave the country. He was not allowed to go and receive the prize. And there must have been about six or eight of us in the church and then in a little side room, and they had one bottle of champagne. And with that bottle of champagne, we all obviously drank to his health and, you know, talk to him. So that was a sort of mini interview, but a very special occasion.
Time for some more music, Hella Pick. Tell me about your second disc.
Well, this is something that reminds me and serves as a reminder to me that I am Jewish. I'm proud of being Jewish, but I'm not at all religious. But I've chosen Kaddish, which is the song and the prayer which is said at funerals, but which is really a praise of God and the internal lasting existence of God. And I've chosen Ravel's Kaddish, which is particularly beautiful. I first heard it at a memorial service for a very close friend, and it moved me deeply when I heard it. And so I think on the desert island, I should be reminded that I'm Jewish, amongst many other things.
An incredible piece of music, and I think even if you didn't understand the language, you would know that was a prayer. Recorded in 1928, that was Ravel's Melodie Hebraic Kaddish, sung by Nir Koschutz. Hella Pick, your parents, Ernst and Johanna, divorced when you were small, and it was just you and your mother. What was life like for her before you left Austria?
She came from a middle-class background. She didn't go to university, but she went to finishing school. I still have a handwritten, now rather tatty, cookery book that she wrote while she was at this finishing establishment. Very good recipes in it, except she always just puts the quantities into it, never said, you know, what comes next or first and so on. I had to learn, and I did learn. I mean, she was a very good cook, and I did learn from her later in life.
Austria was annexed by Nazi Germany in March 1938. Tell me what happened to your family then.
Well, my father emigrated to America, and I never saw him again, because he died in 57, 58, and he had in fact taken no interest in my existence at all. And my mother's mother, she was widowed already in 38. She was too old to get a visa to come to England. She got as far as Prague, and in Prague she was arrested and was sent to Theresienstadt, which was obviously one of the concentration camps. And she died there. I mean, we were notified during the war by the Red Cross that she had died. And my mother, she was picked up by the Gestapo one evening, but, you know, fortunately returned.
Time for some more music, Hella Pick. Tell me about your next track.
I spend quite a lot of time in Vienna. I always enjoy going back. And I've chosen one of those typical Viennese songs, and it's sung by the man who drives the Fiaker, which is the horse carriage, which you still see in Vienna today for tourists. And it's just a reminder of the sort of atmospherics, the core and the root of Vienna.
Ich führe zwei Haare berocken, mein Zeugnis steht am Graben. Ach so, wie die zwei Tropfen werden's nicht viel gesehen haben. Arbeitschen, das gibt's nicht. Oh, jetzt hat's nur nicht schlung. Das Höchste war ein Schnäuzer, na sonst zerreißen's mir den Wagen. Vom Land zum Lusthaus vor es, mal in 12 Minuten hin. Mir springt kein Tränen in Galopp, da geht's nur allweit tropf, tropf, tropf. Und wann ist sich so schießen, doch spür es in mir drin, dass ich die rechte Protzen hab, dass ich ein Fiaker bin. A Kutscher, das kann ja jeder werden, aber fahren, das können's nur in der Welt.
Paul Hoabiger and Fiakerlied. Hella Pick, when you were 10, your mother made the incredibly difficult decision to put you on a kinder transport train alone to get you out of Vienna and to the UK. And you arrived at Victoria Station in March 1939. What do you remember of that day?
Well, I knew no English, but the one word I apparently knew, because I was always reminded of that, was to say goodbye. So the way this worked with the kinder transport children was that arrangements were made here for these children to be taken in by individual families mostly. And we came to Liverpool Street by train, and our future guardians were there waiting for us. And when I was introduced to mine, I said goodbye. However, they immediately put me to school. And 3 months later, I got a school report where I seemed to be speaking English and, you know, coping with the work. So I must have learned very fast.
You and your mother settled in the Lake District. Happily, you were reunited after you came to the UK.
I mean, I came in April 1939, and she managed to get to Britain about 6 weeks before the war broke out. And as a woman on her own, the only thing she was allowed to do, because she'd lost everything, you know, she came just with herself. And you could only do domestic work. And she became the cook of a family called Chordy, later became Lord Chordy. And he loved Austrian food, and so that's why she got the job. And they had a house in the Lake District as well as in London. I, in the meantime, had been with foster parents. They asked me to join my mother and come to the Lake District, and they became my family, the Chordys.
I mean, people talk, don't they, about the refugee experience. How much of the shape that your life took do you think is shaped by the experience of being uprooted at a young age? It did set in train a particular sequence of events.
Oh, I'm quite sure. I think one never loses a certain sense of insecurity. It stays with one's whole life, and I think it's shaped a lot of my life, often to my disadvantage, to my loss, because I've grasped for things just simply to be secure in my personal life and in my personal relationships, and as distinct from my journalism, I think a lot of the mistakes that I made, and I made a lot of mistakes, were very largely due to this sort of basic sense of insecurity that I always needed to be reassured to a degree which was unreasonable.
Halepik, tell me about your fourth disc today.
After I left LSE for a time, I did some research work for one of the professors. And then I started looking for jobs and answered an advertisement for a commercial editor of a weekly paper called West Africa, of which I'd never heard. And to my amazement, I was offered the job. So my very first job had the title of commercial editor, which, needless to say, impressed me very much. And quite early on in London, I had to write a review about a West African dance troupe called Les Ballets de Kaito Fodeba, the Ballets of Kaito Fodeba. And this is one of the songs that he used to play.
We're literally dancing in the Desert Island Discs studio to Kaita Fodeba, an African ensemble with Carolinas. So after writing for West Africa, which was a weekly paper, you started working for The Guardian, and that was a major national. How different was that experience?
It was different, and at the same time, it had a lot of common characteristics. But I was on a sharp learning curve, and I was very lucky. I owe so much in my working life to luck. When I left West Africa, I went to The Guardian and said the first non-aligned conference was about to meet in Belgrade. I asked if I could help to cover this summit because a lot of the African leaders that I'd got to know would be there. And The Guardian said, yes, I could work with the then chief diplomatic correspondent, Richard Scott. And somehow Richard failed to arrive for the opening meeting of this conference, so I had to cover it by myself. And the next day, I was the splash, the lead story in The Guardian. Well, you can imagine that that was rather pleasing. Then Richard did arrive, and he normally went to the UN General Assembly, but he really never liked New York, and he went back to London and said it would be quite a good idea if they sent me instead.
Let me ask you about the States. One of the first people that you met as The Guardian's UN correspondent in 1967 was the journalist and broadcaster Alistair Cook, and he was a very influential figure.
Yes, Alistair Cook was the chief correspondent of The Guardian in those days, and he became a really, really close friend. And my first meeting with him, I've never forgotten, because he came to meet me at the United Nations and he bought me a daiquiri. And I had never drunk a daiquiri before. I liked it. So I had a second one and a third one. But I did walk out of the building, as far as I can remember.
What did he tell you about writing?
I think apart from anything else, he always said, if you don't say in your first paragraph what your story is about, then forget it, because people won't stay with you. And he had this incredible ability to start at one point and end up somewhere else. And the whole thing fitted together. It was a complete story, and it always made sense. He was an artist with words, and you know, I don't think anyone can replicate it.
Time for some music. Halepik, tell me about your fifth.
This is Pablo Casals' Song of the Birds. This is a Catalonian song, and Casals himself said what the birds say, they're singing peace, peace, peace. I heard him play this while I was working at the UN, and I'd gone to Puerto Rico on holiday together with someone that I was living with then. And we both sat there, and it was intensely moving.
Pablo Casals, The Song of the Birds, with Pablo Casals on cello and Mieczysław Hoszowski on piano, recorded live at the White House on November the 13th, 1961, with Kennedy in the audience, Hella Pick, who you met.
Well, meeting is a sort of slight exaggeration. I'd got to know quite well Pierre Salinger, who was Kennedy's spokesman, and he invited me to join them all in Hyannisport, their holiday home, for a party. And Pierre took me up to Kennedy, and somehow I managed to stumble and fall straight into his arms. But it was a very brief encounter.
While in the US, you reported on the 1965 Selma March, led, of course, by Martin Luther King to Montgomery, Alabama. Tell me about that experience.
Well, in many ways, unforgettable. It was such an event, that march. And, you know, in retrospect, I realized that I could very well have been murdered on that day, because I was lucky enough to be able to rent a car. And I had walked part of the way, but always went back to the car. And at the end of the first day's march, I was talking to one of my colleagues from the Washington Post, and he was black. And I said, let me give you a ride back, which we did. And, of course, that was, you know, an invitation to be shot, because at that time, you know, people were shot, because a white woman, black man in a car sitting together was simply not done. But we got back. But when we got back to the hotel, when we went to the bar, they asked him to leave. And I covered quite a lot of the other civil rights events during that period, and, you know, it was nasty. And, I mean, the whole march at the end, you know, you knew something had changed. You know, life was never going to be quite the same again.
Time for some music. Hella Pick, tell me about your sixth disc today.
It's Beethoven's Piano Sonata. I've asked for it to be played by the famous Russian pianist Richter. And this takes me back to Poland. And from time to time, Russian artists used to come to give concerts in Warsaw. And my Polish friends said to me, you know, quite apart from the pleasure of hearing these wonderful artists, you will also have the pleasure of being able to buy wonderful caviar, because the Russian artists, however eminent, always came supplied with caviar, which was then sold during the interval for hard currency. So all the foreigners went and bought the caviar. And this record reminds me of those rather curious times, because Richter was one of the artists who came to Warsaw. And on this recording, he plays the Pathetique.
Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 8 in C minor, performed by Sviatoslav Richter. Halepik, you became The Guardian's Eastern Europe correspondent in 1975. How quickly did you adjust to your new surroundings?
Well, I was based in London, and at the time it was a great psychological help to me because I was going to marry Ralph Dahrendorf, who was the director of the London School of Economics, and that had all completely fallen apart, and I was really quite distraught. I'd given up my job as Washington correspondent to come back to London to be with him, and then it all unraveled, and The Guardian gave me Eastern Europe instead. So instead of getting married, I got caught up in the Cold War at very close quarters. And I spent a lot of time in Poland, but I also spent quite a lot of time in East Germany, in Romania and in Bulgaria. East Germany was always very trying because you were followed, you were listened to, you had knocks on the door at night, and it was tough going, but the saving grace always was to go to Yugoslavia, and in those days it was still Yugoslavia. And I remember there was one period in Yugoslavia and Belgrade that I particularly enjoyed, and I shouldn't say this, but this was at the time when Tito was known to be dying. And the world's journalists landed in Belgrade waiting for Tito to die to see what would happen after him. He was still a very, very big figure in those days, a sort of symbol of independence within European communism. And again, I'm afraid this brings me back to caviar again. I'm quite ashamed of myself. But one of the Time magazine correspondents who was based in Moscow at the time had brought large supplies of caviar with him to Belgrade. And a small group of us used to meet in his rooms at the end of the afternoon and ask the hotel to send us up toast. And we would sit there drinking our vodka, consuming our toast with caviar, which was really rather pleasant. Rather nice days in Belgrade waiting for Tito's death. What an awful thing to say, but still, at the time, we enjoyed it. And at the time, even the American ambassador was briefing that Yugoslavia would survive beyond Tito. And of course, we were all wrong.
Time for some more music, Halepik. Tell me about your seventh disc.
This really brings me now to London, to the Wigmore Hall, and to my love of good singers. And one of my favourite baritones is a wonderful person called Thomas Kwasthoff. He's a thalidomide victim, and he's possessed of the most wonderful voice. And his recitals at the Wigmore Hall were always a great experience. And I very much wanted to include a recording in this broadcast. And in the end, I decided for Schubert's Gute Nacht from the Winterreise.
Fremd bin ich eingezogen, fremd zieh ich wieder aus. Der Mai war mir gewogen mit manchem Blumenstrauß. Das Mädchen sprach von Liebe, die Mutter gar von ihr. Das Mädchen sprach von Liebe, die Mutter gar von ihr. So trübe, der Weg gehüllt in Schnee. Nun ist die Welt so trübe, der Weg gehüllt in Schnee.
Schubert's Gute Nacht from Winterreise, sung by Thomas Kwasthoff with Charles Spencer on piano. Halepik, as someone who knows the business better than most, what do you make of the health of journalism today?
Well, I think it's in great difficulties. For the last almost 20 years, I've been working for a small think tank for George Weinfeld's Institute of Strategic Dialogue. I did a lot of work on the media exchange between European and Chinese journalists. But, you know, the whole media scene has changed and is in many ways in a very perilous situation, because the challenge is to preserve the professionalism in journalism at a time when social media allows anybody to become sort of citizen journalists and to remain professional, to be able to distinguish truth from fiction, and to be able to distinguish reporting facts from comment, is something that really is essential, but it's something that you have to understand and to learn and to know how to do. And the whole problem is, how do the traditional media organizations find business models that works for them, that allow them to maintain the professionalism and indeed allow them to continue their existence? And it is a huge problem. And I think everybody is searching for the answers.
You are going to be cut off from news and current affairs on our island, of course, Hellepic. How do you think you'll cope with that?
I will try to cope with it. I mean, I've lived alone now for quite a long time, so I'm used to being on my own. I do need company, but somehow I'm going to have the company in my mind and in my memory. And I hope I'm going to have lovely weather. I hope I can swim. I don't have to worry about rain or anything like that. And the desert island is big enough for me to be able to walk.
I think I can confirm we can do lovely weather, swimming and walking. Absolutely no problem. Let's have some more music. What's it going to be for your eighth disc?
Well, it's going to be the last scene from The Marriage of Figaro. Opera is one of my great loves, and Mozart operas are my even greater love. And The Marriage of Figaro is really one of my great favourites. And I will always use every opportunity I have to see a good opera production.
Gente, gente, allarmi, allarmi! Il padrone!
Gente, gente, aiuto, aiuto!
Son perduto!
Cosa vende, cosa vende?
Io scelerà Tomma Gianni, Tomma Infamato, le conquiste d'Aider!
Son stordito, sbalordito, ordito di parte, peggiore siete!
In pan resistete, uscite, madama, il premio l'avrete di vostro destà!
E faccio mia figlia,
la madre,
madama,
scappata e la trama, e la perdita è qua, la perdita è qua.
Perdono, perdono.
No, no, non saranno. Perdono, perdono. La madre, non guardarlo.
Gente, gente, all'armi, from the finale of Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, with Bryn Terfel as Figaro, Rodney Gilfrey as the Count, and Hilevi Martin-Pelto as the Countess, conducted by John Elliott Gardner. So we turn now, Hellepic, to the books. I give you the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and you can choose one book of your own. What's it going to be?
Well, my book is going to be Matthew Paris's book called Scorn. This is a book that contains witticisms, expressions of contempt, insults through the ages. Whatever page you open it on, you find something that will make you laugh. So it's really worth taking with me.
And it's all yours. And a luxury item too.
I toyed between taking all the loose photographs that I have that I've never stuck into an album to remind me of my life and happy times, hopefully. But then in the end, I decided what I really want is one of those custom-made armchairs that put your legs up, your arms up. I don't want to sleep on the ground all the time. It's bound to be rough. So I want to be comfortable while I'm on the island. So that's what I'm going to have.
A really comfy recliner.
With a specially chosen fabric, of course.
OK, I will. Well, I'm going to do some research and get that made up.
Definitely.
That'd be wonderful. And if you could only keep one of your eight discs, which would you save?
Well, in the end, I've decided it's got to be Mozart, so it'll be The Marriage of Figaro.
Hella Pick, thank you very much for sharing your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
I really like the image I have of Hella with her feet up in a comfy chair listening to her music choices. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. Other journalists and foreign correspondents featured in the Desert Island Discs back catalogue include Christina Lamb, Robert Fisk, John Pilger and Alex Crawford. A correspondent who also witnessed many significant world events is Dame Anne Leslie. Sue Lawley cast her away in 2004.
She is, she admits, quote, not unlike P.G. Woodhouse's fierce Aunt Agatha, who ate broken bottles and wore barbed wire next to the skin. She is Anne Leslie. Not Anne, that's an image you would necessarily promote, as I understand it, when you're out in the field, because you like playing the kind of brainless bird, don't you?
Well, in the sort of countries I tend to work in, they're very contemptuous of women. And the way to get round this problem with them is to be as bird-brained as you possibly can, because they don't see you as a threat. And I always remember Dame Freya Stark, who is the wonderful adventurer who used to go to mad, bad and dangerous countries, and she wrote that the great advantage of being a woman is that you can always pretend to be more stupid than you are and everyone believes you. And what she meant was every man believes you. So I go round looking, frankly, like some bird-brained dimbo. And I have a huge handbag, which is full of rubbish, which I then empty onto an apparatchik's desk, saying, I have got the permissions, I just can't find them. And, of course, he can't stand this rubbish. And also, I remind him of his mother, and he just wants me out of the room.
But it's worked with people rather more dangerous than just sort of people at visa desks, hasn't it? It's worked with kind of gun-toting guerrillas.
It works very well at checkpoints. It particularly worked in the Balkans, which were always manned by people with gold or silver teeth. You knew they were killers. And you'd turn up at one of these checkpoints, and what I used to do is fish out of my handbag pictures of my daughter. And they would take out of their stained blood and vomit caked uniforms pictures of their daughters and their sons and everything. And they would just, then after that, weeping sentimentally, let me through. Whereas if I came in looking like a war correspondent, they'd know what to do with me.
But you've used your femininity, haven't you, in less dangerous situations than that? Or, I don't know, perhaps it was more dangerous. I mean, didn't you do the Dolly Bird act in order to get a scoop out of Muhammad Ali back in the 60s?
On the whole, I always try not to look like a journalist. And Muhammad Ali was coming into London for a big fight. I knew nothing about boxing. So I dressed up, lots of eyelashes and fur and makeup, and stood apart from all the journalists. And I knew that Muhammad Ali had a lot of people in his entourage who were extremely interested in Dolly Birds. And one of them clocked me and asked if I'd like to meet the champ. And I said, sure. And he showed me...
Waggling your handbag.
Yes, he showed me into the back of Muhammad Ali's Rolls. And as we drove off, with all the press noting that he had a new blonde by his side, I rolled down the window and shouted, I'm Anne Leslie, the Daily Express, actually. I've scooped you. And Muhammad Ali thought that was incredibly funny. And we got on like a house on fire after that.
Dame Anne Leslie. You can hear that programme on BBC Sounds, where you'll find more than 2,000 editions of Desert Island Discs, which you can download and listen to whenever and wherever you like. My guest next time will be the artist Jeremy Deller. I hope you'll join us.